You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 31st of March 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. As it's Thursday, we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. This is being pre-recorded. It's a little bit earlier than usual. I'm very grateful to you for being up early in the morning. How are you doing, sir?
10 o'clock. Eastern Standard Time in the morning is barbaric. I cannot believe I was forced to awake at this early hour, but you know, I forgive you. It's okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And thank you for getting the notes to me a day early as well. Today, we're going to be talking about the peace talks that have just taken place in Turkey between Ukraine and Russia. Russia is eager for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Ukraine. But it won't accept any Western mediation during its talks with Kiev, the Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said. We're ready to give diplomacy a chance, that's why we agreed to the talks, which are resuming in Istanbul, Lavrov said during a video conference on Monday with the Serbian media. The discussions are scheduled to continue on Tuesday. The Turkish government, which has good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, has put a great deal of effort into getting the two sides around the negotiating table, Lavrov explained. However, there is no need to include the EU or the US, which support Kiev in the conflict, in the peace process, according to the minister. There are many examples of times when the achievements of diplomacy were shattered by Western colleagues. They cannot be trusted anymore, Lavrov opined. I wouldn't want to see any shuttle diplomacy from our Western partners because they've already done their shuttling in February 2014 in Ukraine, and in February 2015 in Minsk, he added, and we'll have a look at those in a minute. I mean, there's a couple of points about this, isn't it, that he's talking to the Serbian media, and the Serbian media have been supportive of Russia. Serbia has not put Russia under sanctions along with the rest, and I think Turkey is sort of playing both sides here, isn't she? What do you make of this, Matt?
Well, we've done shows on Turkish diplomacy in the past and how, you know, Machiavellian they are, playing whatever side happens to be winning. Remember, they shot down the Russian fighter during the Syrian conflict, apologized for that and gave some concessions. But, you know, the propagandists today are saying that this eagerness for a diplomatic solution must mean that they're losing. And yet it was the same thing when the Eastern Republics defeated the Ukrainian army and then said, okay, well, now we're eager for negotiations. They're eager for it because they don't want any more civilian centers being shelled or destroyed. They've been proceeding very slowly for a long time now, or I guess a month, for that very reason. And, you know, there are rumors out there that, you know, Western generals and admirals have taken over the Ukrainian command, but I find those very hard to believe. Someone said, I forget who it was yesterday, that the problem with defeating Ukraine is that they're, like Turkey was before World War I, commanded by Western generals. I reject that because I don't think a Western general from, you know, Britain or the U.S. can just walk in and take command over a military apparatus they're not familiar with. A soldiery that they know very little about and a language that they don't speak. Now, they're interested in negotiations because they don't want any more of the country that they could still benefit from and benefit being destroyed.
Well, it seems to me as if they've achieved their objectives. They had two objectives, to demilitarize the country, and they did that. They took out all the airfields. Ukraine doesn't have an air force anymore. And they wanted to denazify the place. And that's what they were doing in Mariupol. That was the hangout of the Azov battalion. They surrounded themselves with human shields. It's quite obvious by the destruction of the place that they were hiding in civilian areas. 90% of the city has been flattened. I think they've successfully got rid of Azov battalion now, so they've achieved both their objectives. It was the West that was saying that Putin wants to invade and conquer Ukraine, not Russia. And we're getting back to these details of the Western interference. In February 2014, the EU became the guarantor of the agreements between Ukraine's then-president Viktor Yanukovych and the Maidan protesters in Kiev. Lavrov reminded viewers it was a pinnacle of diplomacy. But by the next morning, the opposition spat on that diplomacy, and the EU had to swallow it. Yanukovych ended up being deposed after violent clashes and fleeing the country, and the new Ukrainian authorities soon sent their military to the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, where most of the population had refused to recognise the coup in the capital. In September of the same year, the Minsk I agreement between the breakaway republics and Kiev was reached in the Belarusian capital, having been negotiated by Ukraine, Russia, Germany and France in the so-called Normandy format. The deal called on the two sides to stop fighting, organise prisoner exchanges, allow deliveries of humanitarian aid and withdraw heavy weaponry. The diplomacy then reached new heights in February 2015, when the agreements that were signed in Minsk ended the war in eastern Ukraine and opened the way to restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity by granting a special status to the Donbass, the minister continued. The second agreement, Minsk II, introduced another ceasefire and paved the way for administrative and political reform in Ukraine, as well as for autonomy and local elections in the Donbass republics. However, Kiev's Western backers were subsequently unable to persuade the Ukrainian government to fulfil its promises. The European Union has proven its incompetence as an organisation that is capable of fulfilling the agreements being reached, Lavrov said. So it's quite logical what he's saying here. It's not just bad eggs and not wanting the EU or the West to have anything to do with it. The EU were the ones that were supposed to be guaranteeing both of these previous agreements, and they both fell through for some reason. What are your thoughts on this, Matt?
Can you imagine the arrogance of, you know, Washington and London claiming that they could be neutral observers and guarantors in this situation? Lavrov is well aware that the Western powers, especially Washington, has reneged on every agreement they've ever been a part of. I was opposed to the Minsk. They're similar. The Minsk II is just a bit more detailed. But I was against Minsk in the first place. I mean, the OSCE was going to be monitoring any kind of a ceasefire. The Ukrainian government had to develop a new constitution that devolved power, which was, laughable. Permanent monitoring of the border, that there was a general amnesty, a release of POWs, of course, humanitarian concerns. And Section 10 is odd because it says you have to withdraw the illegal militias and equipment and mercenaries from the territory of Ukraine, which I'm not really sure. First of all, it assumes that eastern Ukraine is actually Ukraine. It assumes that there's any territorial integrity to defend. And of course, the economic recovery program was going to be, controlled by the West. This was a disaster, and it just gave. Remember, there is no Ukrainian government. Ukraine is a colony of the West. It doesn't have a functional economy, so it better do what it's told. But this first Minsk agreement is pretty serious. There was no chance that any of this was going to be done, and the only benefit. Or Russia had very little benefit from signing this, which they did, but it would reject the legitimacy of the Eastern Republics, or at least give them tremendous autonomy, which, as the years go by, as you know how these things work, that doesn't last very long. And when I saw initially the program of economic recovery, that's just it. And now I'm thinking Western corporations going in there and taking over. So I wasn't all that upset to see Minsk go. But at least it gave the side some breathing room, and it was a full victory. Now it's irrelevant because Russia has completely accepted, as they should have a long time ago, the independence of those two states. So, but the big takeaway here is that there is no way that Russia or any rational person can possibly accept the U.S., Britain, or the EU, any EU state, maybe except Germany, as a mediator or a guarantor of anything. And what, you know, what do they care about Ukraine in the first place? The EU and the West gets very little from it, except as this unsinkable aircraft carrier. And that's, as you said before, that was the whole purpose of the invasion, to make sure that that aircraft carrier status is negated. And of course, yeah, they've reached their goals. And the best part of it is that they've blown up in the initial invasion many of the Western finance media outlets. So that by itself is a victory.
I think Minsk 2, the difference between Minsk 2 and Minsk 1 was the autonomy for the region, that Ukraine was supposed to give them a special status as a sort of autonomous region governing parts of their own affairs. I think that was the important bit, and they just completely ignored that. Well, Russia sent its troops into Ukraine over a month ago, following Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk ceasefire agreements and Russia's eventual recognition of the Donbass republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. Moscow has now demanded that Ukraine officially declare itself a neutral country that will never join the US-led NATO military bloc, while Kiev insists the Russian offensive was completely unprovoked and has denied claims it had been planning to retake the two republics by force. Well, what about all the evidence of these militias continually bombing the Donbass that's just been kept out of the Western media for the last 8 years? I mean, this just hasn't stopped. It was supposed to stop after the Minsk agreement, which was, 6 years ago, and they've just continued doing it. I mean, they can't just expect to continue doing it and Russia not to respond. I mean, that's the way it seems to me. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, and we've been talking about this for a long time now. From the signing of these agreements to, you know, the start of the war, the Red Cross estimates something like between 13 and 15,000 civilian deaths. And that comes from not only militia shelling, but Ukrainian regulars shelling this area, claiming that there are no such thing as civilians. Although in this case, the Geneva Conventions would apply because they wear uniforms there. I mean, they consider themselves a state. They have the potential. I mean, they have an outlet to the sea and everything. They have an industry. They have raw materials. They're in good shape if this war ends. The only big loser is Ukraine, and they're going to lose anyway here. But this notion of unprovoked, you know, that ship sailed a long time ago. They're well aware that with the whole point of sending all this equipment into Ukraine was to, you know, fight this war to the last Ukrainian, and at least take the Eastern Republics by force. That statement was written at the PR department at the Pentagon, having nothing to do with reality. But, again, Johnson's law being what it is, no one really knows any different.
Well, if they'd just given them that limited autonomy, they could have retained their territorial integrity, and Donetsk and Luhansk would have remained a part of Ukraine. They would have just had limited autonomy so that they didn't have to be enemies with Russia. That was all they wanted. They didn't want to fall out with the rest of Ukraine, and they didn't want to fall out with Russia either. Well, let's have a look at the peace talks here. Russia has agreed to meet Kiev halfway and will allow a meeting of its leaders to be held on the same day that the final version of a peace treaty is pre-approved by the two nations' foreign ministers, Moscow's top negotiator said on Tuesday after a new round of talks in Istanbul. Previously, Moscow had insisted that a meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky could only be set after the deal had been finalized. Vladimir Medinsky described the talks in Turkey as constructive and said his delegation had received a clearly outlined position on what Kiev sought to achieve. The written proposal, which includes Ukraine's pledge to remain a neutral nation and that it will not try to obtain any weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, will be relayed to Putin, he said. And this has always really surprised me. I mean, why does Zelensky want to have a face-to-face meeting with Putin over this? I'm suspicious of that. Maybe he might attack him or something. I mean, what do you make of this, the importance of both of them meeting face to face, Matt?
Well, I mean, to me, it makes a certain amount of sense. The two of them in the same room gives the Ukrainians a sense of equality, that we're just as important as Russia is. We're two equals meeting to discuss important problems. So the symbolism there, among many other things, symbolism there is important. Zelensky has fled the country a month ago. He has had very little to do with the military response to the Russian invasion. The propaganda in the West has just got into overdrive. But anyone who knows anything realizes that, you know, he's not a military man. He doesn't know anything. And how much of this had anything to do with his desires? You know, he ran on a more or less neutral or semi-pro-Russian ticket. We talked about that too, and I wasn't that upset when he was elected. But he's a comedian. He's an actor, which of course makes a lot of sense for the West. The West appointed him precisely because he is an actor. He could do as he pleases. He could wear costumes. You know, the pictures we've seen of him. But I think it has a lot to do with the two of them appearing to be equal. That I'm not this, you know, guy who just ran the country in the West. The West actually runs everything. No, they're seen as two equal partners. And as far as the rest of it's concerned, Russia's going to have to be the one to define these terms. You know, what militarization means, what weapons of mass destruction refers to. And beyond that, Russia's going to have to make it clear that it's not going to be a free-for-all for Western corporations to go in and simply absorb the country. The economic element is usually left out of these things, and I think that's a mistake. What happened in Crimea a few years ago was their boom in construction and everything else because of the opening of the Russian, Chinese, and Indian market. We talked last week about India leaning towards the Russian side. This they're on the verge of a total disaster, the West, if they haven't reached it already. So this is, you know, this face-to-face meeting, this is about Zelensky appearing in charge and not simply a colonial administrator.
Well, I guess it could be conducive as well if he doesn't have the West there and Putin doesn't have his advisors there and it's a genuine one-on-one meeting like Trump had with Kim Jong-un. I guess it could be conducive. Coinciding with Medinsky's statement to the press, the Russian Defense Ministry announced it was drastically reducing its military operations in some parts of Ukraine, including near the capital Kiev. The ministry cited the talks moving into the practical dimension as the reason for the change. Medinsky explained the announcement of a de-escalation on the approaches to Kiev, among other reasons, by the fact that key decision makers are based in the capital. Russia's top negotiator also underlined that there is a difference between de-escalation and ceasefire. This is not a ceasefire. This is our desire to gradually come to a de-escalation of the conflict, at least in these areas. And we understand that there are people in Kiev who need to make decisions, he said. We do not want to put this city at additional risk, Medinsky stressed. And that's good. I mean, you look at this, look at what's happened to Mariupol. I couldn't believe that Zelensky was saying that the leader of the militia in Mariupol, he wants to give him the highest Ukrainian award for defending Mariupol. I mean, how has he defended it? 90% of the place is absolutely destroyed. He failed to defend it. To defend it, they should have just given themselves up. That would have been the defense. And clearly, they don't want to do this to Kiev. I mean, who is going to pay to rebuild everything as well? I mean, I'm assuming Russia are going to pay to rebuild the damage that they've actually done. That is what normally happens, isn't it? I mean, America pays to rebuild Iraq after it's destroyed it and then takes the money back from Iraq. I'm assuming that is what Russia is expecting to do here. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I think that's something that the West is going to have a problem with, because if this is the state for the most part. Well, there'll be private actors too, but the state will be the most important actor in rebuilding it. They're going to rebuild it in Russia's interest, which I think is the same thing as the Ukrainian interest. Rebuilding its economic infrastructure to be able to freely insert it into the Eastern trading bloc. This is why there's a chance that this stuff is going to collapse. Because while it's true, the key policymakers are not in Kiev. They're mostly in Virginia and D.C. and New York City. The West sees, and this is the economics is at the core here. The West sees an opportunity to absorb Ukraine and continue to use this to increase, you know, EU discipline and unity against Russia, which of course is a fantasy, but it's at the Ukrainian point of view. They want to come in and absorb it. They're going to have these negotiations, which may not even make the newspapers, where the economic elite from the two sides are going to have to decide what reconstruction means. I don't even know what de-escalation means. I don't know, is that fewer bullets fired? less media coverage. I don't know what that means. Yeah, and the ceasefire, you know, that's what you had between the two Koreas for decades, rather than a straight out peace treaty. Russia's been talking about de-escalation for years and years and years now. It's the Ukrainians that have been pushed to do this. You know that they're a colony of the West because none of this is in Ukraine's interest. None of this ever has been. Yeah, the economy has been in a free fall since the 90s, and yet they're investing massively in naval bases and a navy alone, an air force, all these things that cost a small fortune, and while neglecting everything else, which was the opposite of what happened in Crimea after the referendum. None of this, as far as the Ukrainians are concerned, at any except for the oligarchy, certainly the last thing it is in their interest. This has been a disaster for them, and so the West simply is using Ukraine as a cudgel, and Russia had enough of it. That's what this whole thing is about. So a lot of this is going to come down to word definition. It's going to come down to how these things are implemented and who's going to implement them. I could see both Ukrainian and American oligarchs being extremely upset of Russia coming in and rebuilding this, because they're going to rebuild it in their own interest.
Well, I'm thinking by de-escalation, it probably means that they're not going to invade Kiev. They're just going to stay on the outside of it. I mean, they don't really have any reason to do that. The militias were all in Mariupol, and by taking out Mariupol, they then got the whole of that Donbass region and the access to the sea that they needed. Well, David Arakamia, Medinsky's opposite number in the Ukrainian delegation, said Kiev had sought a security guarantee from a number of nations that would work not unlike NATO's mutual self-defense commitment. He named the UK, China, the US, Turkey, France, Canada, Italy, Poland, and Israel as possible guarantors, and claimed that some of them have given their preliminary agreement to serve in that capacity. The proposed security pledge will not apply to the parts of Ukraine whose status remains in dispute, Arakamia said. These include Crimea, which Russia considers its territory, and the breakaway Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, which Russia recognized as sovereign states and whose forces are taking part in ongoing hostilities. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu remarked that he hoped that the outcome of the negotiation would soon lead to a ceasefire and a sustainable political resolution of the crisis. Now, this seems quite reasonable to me, Matt. You know, they do need somebody to defend them, because they haven't really got a military of their own. They do need some guarantors. So, I mean, this would seem to me to be a reasonable solution to the problem. Do you think so?
Well, it depends on who they are. You know, we listed a group of countries, and there's only one, China, that's on the other side. Most of these are, you know, well, every one of them is essentially in the West. I mean, Poland has a national state, but they're still, you know, part of the European orbit, within the European orbit. And when it comes to guaranteeing the security, you can only refer to the fact that these countries are willing to put their military up in a gamble. And I can't picture, you know, Italy or even the U.S. having to use force to guarantee this. It may be like the Americans were part of the enforcing the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt. And that didn't go all that badly. So you're talking of what amounts to a peacekeeping mission. And you notice here that the United Nations isn't mentioned at all. And I think the reason for that is because both, you know, Russia and China have a veto on the Security Council. But this is an odd listing of countries. I also noticed that Germany is not in here. Usually this would be a UN matter. The peacekeepers would go in and that would be the end of it. Although UN peacekeepers are taken from all over the world. And you see this in parts of Africa, where ceasefires are guaranteed by a multinational force under UN auspices. So this may be a combination of things. I think the most reasonable thing would be to use one country from each side to join together and be the guarantor. So a few from India and a few from Spain or something like that. Israel I have a problem with, because they have a colonizing force in Odessa. And they were militarily part of the buildup of Georgia back in 2008. The U.S. is absolutely out of the question, as is London. So the most reasonable thing is to have a few soldiers from both sides of this. And so that at least you have some kind of objectivity.
I was thinking Turkey as well. mean, Turkey, although it is a part of NATO, it is friendly towards Russia. Well, Russia has drastically reduced its military activity near Kiev and Chernigov as talks with Ukraine enter the practical stage, the Deputy Minister of Defence Alexander Fomin announced on Tuesday. Fomin called on Ukraine to fully abide by the Geneva Conventions, including with regards to the humane treatment of prisoners of war. He explained that this decision was taken due to the fact that negotiations on the preparation of an agreement on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Ukraine, as well as on the provision of security guarantees to Ukraine, are entering the practical phase. Reduction of Russian forces' activity is poised to increase mutual trust and to create the necessary conditions for the further development of negotiations and the achievement of the ultimate goal of agreeing and signing the agreement, Fomin said. And I think the interesting part about this is the mention of the treatment of prisoners of war, because we've recently seen video of Russian prisoners of war being shot in the kneecaps and a Ukrainian doctor saying that prisoners of war should be castrated. And I think Zelensky himself has had to make a comment about this, that he didn't want to see prisoners of war mistreated. What do you think of the importance of Fomin bringing this up, Matt?
Yeah, it's of all the issues he can bring up, economic or otherwise, this is one of the things that he makes a point of. And it's pretty important. I've seen the videos you're talking about. Remember, you blow out somebody's kneecaps, they'll never be able to walk again. So that's a particularly nasty form of torture. There aren't a whole lot of POWs, but there could be two or three. And if they're not treated properly, part of the reason not being treated properly is there's no resources. Russia doesn't have this problem. Russia has a ton of prisoners and defectors. Now, I haven't gotten the numbers on defectors yet. It's going to take a while. But Russia actually has the resources to follow the conventions in that respect. The only exception is these militias are not going to be treated as POWs. They're going to be treated as criminal gangs, which is probably correct. The only exception to that would be any of the militias that have been absorbed into the Ukrainian regular forces. Now, these are different stories. I guarantee you, when I uncover this stuff, we'll see that most of these militias are foreign. Like in the Georgian War, they were from all over the world. You know, we're going to uncover a whole lot of, you know, Washington and Virginia-based PMCs sending mercenaries over there, which, by the way, was one of the aspects of the Minsk agreement, that mercenaries are going to be disbanded. In other words, the Ukrainian force is going to be disbanded. You mentioned that Ukraine has no military anymore, which is true, which means the private military corporations are the only thing that they have. So if the Russians say, like in Minsk, they say you're going to have to demobilize all of them, that's the end of Ukrainian resistance. But as I said before, Russia has the interest more than anybody else. And some, by the way, these militias are not going to like this. They were going to kill Poroshenko a few years ago because he's refused to invade the breakaway republics. You know, weapons of mass destruction, demilitarization, whatever's left of these, you know, the Azov units and everything, they're not going to take this. That wing is going to want to destroy these negotiations, and they'll probably figure out a way to commit an atrocity and blame it on Russia. They've already said they were going to do this. But the way this is written here, what we just read, is not something that these militias and that you know, bizarre, like the chimera nationalists, as I've called them, are going to accept this at all, is the Ukrainian side is going to be more intransigent than the Russian side.
Well, let's finish up here with a discussion on the root causes of the conflict. Dmitry Suslov, the Deputy Director for Research at the Council on Foreign and Defence Policy and Deputy Director of the Centre for Comprehensive European and International Studies of the Faculty of World Economy and International Affairs of the National Research University Higher School of Economics, believes there is a different reason why the actions of politicians deviate so much from what the expert community prescribes. It's not that Western politicians refuse to listen to foreign policy analysts, it's that they listen to the wrong ones. There was no unity among the experts in the West, no consensus at all. It was mainly the foreign policy realists from the US and Europe that had warned about the dangers of expanding NATO. The problem was, after the end of the Cold War, the realists' influence in the Western foreign policy establishment has diminished significantly, Suslov said. According to him, once the Cold War ended, the liberal viewpoint quickly gained popularity among Western expert circles and policymakers. The idea was, first off, that Russia was in a state of impending and irreversible decline, and that it would not dare challenge the West in any shape or form. It was believed that Russia would eventually fall in line and join the right side of history, from the West's point of view at least, would fit into the NATO-centric paradigm in Europe and take on a subordinate position on the sidelines of global politics. This was the vision espoused by liberals and neoconservatives, and it clearly dominated over the realists' position, he continued. This only seemed natural. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, many had the feeling that the balance of power and the previous patterns of international relations suddenly became obsolete. Now, they thought, everything would be different. International relations would be guided by a brand new set of considerations, while those of the realists, along with their notions of geopolitics, would fade away into obscurity. The end of history, a concept advocated by Francis Fukuyama in the 1990s, gained a lot of traction during this period. It is well known that Fukuyama's interpretation of this idea had a powerful influence on George W. Bush and his foreign policy. In his book titled The End of History and the Last Man, he announced that the age of ideological confrontation, authoritarianism, revolutions, and war was finally over, as all states would eventually embrace liberal democracy, modeled after the United States. Fukuyama is now making predictions about the outcome of the current conflict in Ukraine. He believes that military defeat for Russia in Ukraine is imminent and will result in China not daring to invade Taiwan. This, according to Fukuyama, will revive the spirit of 1989, which will capture people's hearts and bring the world back to the path towards the end of history. What are your thoughts on the first bit of this, and also what Francis Fukuyama is saying, Matt?
Well, I was in grad school, in graduate school, actually, as this stuff was being developed. It overlaps completely. I got a chance to attend some of these conferences. And the naivete, the deliberate self-deception, having to do, of course, with grant money and where they stand in the academic hierarchy, was beyond my comprehension. Can you imagine knowing so little about history that you would believe that because the Cold War so-called ended and the Soviet Union fell apart, that therefore Russia, which is a different story, is falling into irreversible decline? I remember these very smug analyses. And of course, Russia's been through this kind of thing many times before. They don't seem to notice that. Fukuyama has been proven wrong in almost everything he said in his famous end of history idea. So why is anyone listening to him now? He's going to be wrong about all of this. The war is pretty much over. And of course, Russia got everything it wanted. And yet that's the case in academia all the time. People who have been dead wrong, you know, the people at the economics department at Harvard University who were part of the reconstructing of the Russian and Ukrainian economy in the 90s, people are still taking them seriously. You know, Lawrence Summers and all this. Lawrence Summers presided over the decay of two economies, at least, you know, in terms of justification. The Justice Department shut down some of the institutes at Harvard University because of the fraud and the disaster that it caused. And yet they're still getting jobs. They still have tenure. They're still considered a genius economists. So being right or being wrong isn't relevant here. It's where you stand in the academic hierarchy. And the academic hierarchy is who's able to bring in the most grants. And the money, of course, is on the neocon side. But the success of both Russia and China prove that the end of history is nonsense. Or if it's anything, it's still nationalism, as you know, I've always stated. But he's still living in his fantasy world, thinking that that's it, Russia's lost, and therefore China's going to be terrified. This is, you know, China, Russia's using, what, 5% of its military capacity at this point. And, of course, that's like the Russo-Japanese War. You know, Japan, Ukraine using 100, 120% of their capacity. So this man is starting to believe his own nonsense. He's been very well paid for this kind of thing. And he lives in a bubble. And that's this kind of nonsense that you're getting. He's been wrong in pretty much everything he said in his career.
He's another one of these experts that is not actually paying attention to reality. I think it's incredibly arrogant to think that liberal democracy is the ultimate form of political governance and everybody is just going to love it and fall in line with America. Incredibly arrogant. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners. For listening, Grandpa Dan will be with us tomorrow. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.